What's up, everyone? Welcome to Dipped in Tone. I'm Rhett.
I'm Zach.
Welcome to another episode. We're going to keep this intro tight today because we have a very, very special guest. The one and only Julian Lodge is joining us today for what is, I think, my favorite interview that we've ever done.
It's really good. It's really good. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. We back to normal after NAMM. Sure. And everything. We took a week off, went snowboarding in Colorado with my childhood best friend. They live out there in Durango. So
Durango.
It's been a week on the hill. It was great.
Nice.
How about you?
Oh, it's just been this Herculean Deluxe launch.
Yep.
Probably the biggest launch we've ever done. Pretty crazy. And I realized when we started making them, like, oh, you know, that bass knob doesn't do what I wanted it to do. So I literally, on about 200 circuit bo- or 300 circuit boards, I, with tweezers and stuff, like, swapped a teeny tiny, I mean, like, I'm not exaggerating. It's like the caps are like, you know, that big. Swapped like one cap, but we got them all out, and like, it's just been incredible. So
yeah, you pulled me when you were on your way home and you're like, dude, I just realized the bass control isn't right. And I was like, that sucks.
I moved on the schematic because, like, you know, there's so many different ways to write a value of something. I moved a decimal point, and it changed the value by like 1,000, you know? So
math do be like that sometimes.
Yeah. Know? And I was like, that shouldn't be that. It should be this. And then I was looking at it. I was like, oh no, I forgot to type it the right way. And so when I ordered the boards, it was just, you know, I thought it was right and it was wrong. But all the subsequent ones, I don't have to do that. But apart from that, I'm still getting over whatever sickness I have held on to since January. But I think I'm on the end of it.
Man, well, you'll start to see those on Reverb one day, the early Herculean bass.
I hope no one will ever know. I hope my work is clean enough to where if you open it, you'd be like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
But,
well,
yeah.
I want to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is Stumac. Visit stumac.com/dippedintone. Get 10% off your order. You know, we're changing seasons now. Things are warming up here in Atlanta. Humidity is getting back to normal. I can see on my little humidity gauge hydrometer over there. We're sitting right at 49%. So
pretty
a couple of my guitars need some TLC. And Stumac is the place to go if you need tools for setups or refins or whatever you're trying to do.
Yeah, and thank you to everybody over on Patreon. If you want to learn more about Dipped in Tone Patreon, look in the description below. You can get links and learn about the tiers and all of that stuff. So thank you all for joining up and supporting this show. We appreciate it.
Awesome. All right. With the intro out of the way, let's jump into our interview with arguably one of the greatest guitar players to ever live, Julian Lodge. Julian, thanks so much for joining us, man. It is a huge honor to have you on the show today.
Thank you. The feeling is mutual. I'm a fan of all of yours, and I've spent many evenings watching your videos, Rhett, and learning a lot. I know you did something on, you featured me in one, but I was too shy to watch it, so I never saw that. But I've seen everything else you've done.
That's a huge honor, man. Thank you. It really means a lot. Yeah, you're one of my favorite players around today. Not just because of your playing, but because of your sound. Hmm. And if we can, we'll just jump right in.
By all means.
So I was watching the interview you did with Rick. And in that interview, you mentioned something that I think, was it Jim Hall told you, where you said an amp allows you to play quietly?
Yeah.
So expand on that a little bit, because I've never heard anybody say that before.
Oh, God. Well, you play that way. What's funny, that I'm happy to talk about it. You do that naturally. No, it's just the concept that if you look at the history of guitar, especially in jazz, just for the sake of argument, you know, it comes from, we come from the banjo. That was part of these Dixieland bands. Then you have tenor guitars and then acoustic guitar, you know, people like Eddie Lang or Carl Kress or George Barnes or all these great players. And the guitar kind of inherently had a muscular percussive thing to it, you know, just kind of popped out of the ensemble. And the physicality of it was part of what was, I think, its appeal, that you kind of, you dig in and you get growl. It's kind of like overdrive, but acoustic, on an acoustic instrument. And then as the amplifiers included in modern jazz players, you know, obviously with Charlie Christian, also with George Barnes and everybody that followed, there's, in those earlier days, you including Jim Hall, you hear the sensibility where they look at the amplifier as this giant microscope, you know, under which you can touch the guitar sensitively and sensually and delicately. And then the amplifier just kind of just does that. It amplifies, it puts it up to a level where everyone can hear it. So it allows the physicality to kind of go down and for the sensuality, sonically speaking, to go up. And when, so I came to Jim a couple times with issues I was having, and I forget the one that instigated that response from him, but it was, I just knew what he meant, you know, work less, let it announce to the world how you're touching the instrument. And it's tricky, you know, I mean, we all know it's tricky because you, if you hear yourself loud through an amp, you also feel it's stimulating. And I don't know about you, but I often get overstimulated by an amplifier. So I feel more intensity, more resonance, and I dig in more. And then it's this kind of collapse, this collapsed awareness where I can't feel anything. I don't really know what's going on, but I can't tell if I'm loud or quiet. I can't, you know, and so on and so on. So, yeah, you look at it as a microscope that kind of lets you off the hook.
So do you see the relationship of the guitar and the amp as like a, like a symbiotic thing, they're working together, or is the amp more of there just to represent whatever you're putting into it through the guitar?
It's a great question. I mean, there's a third component. Yes, to it's the guitar interfacing with the amp, but most importantly, it's how that interfaces with the room you're in. You know, that's, to me, that's paramount. I've played so much not thinking about that, and then I played a lot thinking about it, and the difference is really noticeable. Because you're, on one level, none of it matters, you know what I mean? And you, like, the guitar doesn't really matter, the amp doesn't really matter, but the interaction with the space you're in and the ensemble you're with, that's when things get interesting and get emotional, you know? So I've shot myself in the foot by stopping the argument at the amp, you know, because you have this gorgeous sound and it doesn't fit anywhere. You know, we made this guitar, excuse me, Collings and I, we designed two, an acoustic and an electric, but the electric, one of the big things we did when I went down to Austin to try out prototypes was to play the guitar through an amp along with records. So we'd put on albums and then I'd play along with them. And some of the prototypes were great on their own. As soon as you heard them with a drummer or with an ensemble, they sounded kind of like overly fluorescent. You know, it's like, yeah, I hear that good guitar sound. It has nothing to do with the music. And then as we'd make adjustments, the guitar started to just be like a, like an offering to the ensemble. Not an attempt.
That's amazing. Rapper.
Isn't that interesting? Well, it was really educational for me. You know, I learned a lot from doing that.
I think the idea that, because so often as guitar players, especially, you know, when you're practicing, you kind of, we live in a vacuum a bit.
Yeah.
And it is so crucial if you want to play in an ensemble, in a group, or even just along with music, finding something that fits, because we get so like lost in the pursuit of whatever is up here and not how it fits in the space. So that's very interesting.
You're
idea.
Right. I feel that way. And yet I think when push comes to shove, that metric is what decides whether we keep the guitars we buy, you know, whether we sell them. Like the thing we're actually contending with is how are we integrating into the world we live in, you know, apart from our own fascinations with gear and whatnot. So though it can feel alien, I think it's actually really native to most of us. It's just whether we deal with it at what stage. You know, do we wait till it gets to a place where we can't deal with our thing, our guitar, or anymore, and we got to sell it? Or do we practice with that in mind or whatever? And God, I could talk all day about this because I think about it a lot. I also play with a lot of bands that where I'm the only person coming out of a speaker, you know. I was just at the Vanguard, Village Vanguard, this 2 weeks ago with Joe Lovano's band, and Joe, the greatest tenor player, you know, is playing in this room with no mic at all. The bass isn't going through the house. The drums aren't going through the house. And I'm up there with a deluxe style amp, and I've got to sound like I'm just appearing in the air, which is hard when you have a, you know, a speaker that's short shooting out the sound really directionally. So, yeah, oh man, it was so humbling. I did good. Sometimes I didn't. It was really interesting.
So when you're in a situation like that, how are you changing your approach? Are you changing your dynamics on the guitar? Are you changing your chord voicings? Are you changing EQ on the amp?
Yeah, well, not so much on the amp. I'll say that it's not false modesty. I don't want to touch knobs. I set it to a very neutral place where I'm sure there are settings that could help my agenda, but I just don't want to deal with it. I can't be bothered. So that's my own, that's a me problem. It's voicings. It's looking for, I think a lot about, frequency buildup, you know? So if you're dealing in the middle of the instrument and you're dealing with certain voicings and they're, oh wow, they sound so impactful and, man, this is sounding great. Well, about a chorus later, I'm so tired of that buildup because I've had this frequency, this mid-range thing that's mounting and mounting and mounting in the room. So I do find myself kind of bursting those bubbles a lot, you know, or trying to get out of a frequency range of the guitar before it becomes, I guess, just too much of a thing. So I'll stay in the mid range. Okay. This is about to get a little too dense. I'm going to go high. I'm going to leave space to recalibrate. I'm going to go low. I'm going to get something sharper, play something with more attack. I'm going to use only my thumb, so it's more dulcet. Just cause no sound is empirically good or bad. It's just kind of how it fits into the narrative. Right. So, so to a certain degree, right, it's about zooming out, you know, and listening to the band and kind of, and it's hard to do, you know, like you're in it, but you also want to be out of it. And that's just physically impossible. So you compromise, you try to gauge the situation the best you can from a bird's eye view, knowing that it's not actually a bird's eye view. I'm definitely hearing way more guitar than every other instrument, but I'm trying to hear as little of it as I can, so I can still hear what they're doing. And there's also, oh God, I'm such a nerd for this. we should stop now. No, there's other things too, of like intervallic things. If you deal in a lot of triadic information for long periods of time, that can create up like a tonal buildup where you're like, okay, for the last 10 minutes, everything I've done has expressed what key we're in. And if you're playing with certain players, especially someone like Lovano or John Zorn, a lot of their stuff is atonal, you know, they're or polytonal. So they're dealing in multiple keys simultaneously. And so that's often a cue when I start hearing, God, I hear a lot of this. Yeah, the tune's in C and I hear a lot of C. I need to start offering things that break up that thing. And in doing so, my tone becomes less of an issue. Okay, I'll go up a half step for a while, or I'll go a fourth away for a while, or, and you hear these, I mean, it's, I think a lot of that stuff for me comes from Alban Berg, you know, his kind of deal, not just Schoenberg's 12 tone thing, but Berg, and also a lot of Messiaen, who dealt with polytonality in a really, how do I say it? I don't know how to say it. In a way where you kind of, you use harmony to give you tone, I guess is the only way to say it. If you want a timbral shift, you add a different tonal center. You don't change your EQ.
Wow.
There's other people who are better equipped to speak to that than I am, but that's some stuff I've been obsessed with for a while.
You're in a safe space to get nerdy about this stuff, because that's, you know, that's what we are here to do.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I'm not this good, so it's...
Sure you are.
I'm not either, so I'm just listening to you say stuff like, yeah, man, totally, yeah. I go forth away from time to time, you know? So I want to go back to the Collings, your collaboration with Collings, specifically on the 470 JL.
Yeah.
So I've had the opportunity to play three or four of them. Mm-hmm. And there's been a consistent thing that I've felt through all of them, which is they are probably the most touch sensitive electric guitars I think I've ever played. They are so sensitive to how hard you're hitting the string, and it changes, it shifts how you are playing. It almost forces you to play to the guitar. Mm. Was that intentional? When did you go into that collaboration with Collings with that in mind?
Well, I think so. I think they, my reference for electric guitars comes from, you know, more the Tele world. And I've played a lot of the old ones that different collectors and friends have, and some in one that Nacho from Nacho Casters has. And one thing I've been struck with was with the really early ones, like the first, within the first 10 Tellys ever made, there is a quality of touch sensitivity that's astounding, and age, you know, and we all know that affects things and the way it transmits through the pickups and the metal and whatnot. So going to Collings, I wanted to kind of cultivate touch sensitivity, even though at times it can feel like it's not in your best interest as a player, which is a little bit masochistic and also, But when it sings, when you nail it, it really sings. And when you don't, it's okay. And I remember we did discuss, you know, whether that would have any appeal to anybody but me. And I think my argument was that I don't expect most people who play that guitar to want such hypersensitivity that they're walking on eggshells. That's not very inviting. But the flip side to it is when you play that guitar, let's say on the bridge pickup, and you turn it up loud and you overdrive it and you kind of say to hell with the sensitivity, all of those sensitivities kind of get transferred to how the pickup responds and how the overdrive responds. So all along I thought it was almost a better rock machine than it was a jazz guitar. I just wanted to use it for jazz. And that's when the conversation shifted a little bit, where they go, oh, cool. And then I heard certain people playing it. Like, you know, I remember Jeff Tweedy playing one of the early prototypes, because I had it with me when I was at the Loft in Chicago. And it's unbelievable. And it was screaming through a Princeton that was dimed. And it was just like, that's going to be cool, I think, for people who play that way. I don't play that way, but it's fabulous, kind of like an old Gretsch would, or you know, any old guitar with those Dynasonic style pickups. So I confess, I think it's more for singer songwriters and rock musicians. The jazz musicians who want to use it, I think, get to enjoy that thing that you're talking about. But I don't know, it's not for everyone. Like, no guitar is really.
Mm. Can we talk a little bit about the Dynasonic thing, because that, you know, apart from Gretsch doing reissues and using those pickups, it seems like it's a bit of a forgotten pickup. And it was really interesting to see that show up on your guitar, because it is, I mean, those are Fidelity machines.
Yeah. Well said.
What was the decision to go with that sort of pickup?
Well, I was fascinated with them for a while, you know, not only from playing Gretsch's and loving them in Gretsch guitars, but there's that great photograph of Les Paul with an early Les Paul where he's got a P9, what looks like a P90, but it's clearly a Dynasonic poking through the P90 case. It's kind of, and I always thought, that's interesting, because there's something, I could see why that would work on a Les Paul. I always thought that was a beautiful photograph, and kind of, you know, one of those photographs that you can hear, you know, you're looking at and you're like, I know what that sounds like. That's probably so sick. And then I have always been fascinated with Stapler P90s, which are kind of a similar version of that.
Yeah.
There's one, if not two, albums where Jim Hall played a Les Paul. I think Gibson maybe gave it to him. It was like a departure from him playing an archtop. And he played, you guys know better than me, one of those old black Les Pauls that came with the Stapler.
Yeah.
P90s. and it sounds great. One is a Chico Hamilton record. I forget the name of it. But I was always really interested in his tone because I thought, wow, it's my hero, jazz hero, playing a solid body, and it's those pickups. And I think I'm thinking too much about it. I think they probably gave him a guitar and he played it on a session, you know, but I thought, well, oh, I totally get why that you could cross over to that guitar from being an archtop player. So they were on my radar, I guess, this idea of a big magnet that super high fidelity that gives this beautiful low end and kind of crystalline top that you as the player can then shape with your touch. That's the premise. And then, you know, I've been working with Ron Ellis for so many years on pickups, and I immediately wanted to make one with him. So what's in the guitar? It's an Ellis Sonic, which is Ron just doing his, bringing his sensibilities and brilliance to this pickup to I think, refine and advance the concept of that style of pickup. I much prefer it to a Dynasonic, you know, the Ellis Sonic.
Right.
And then the coolest part, what sewed it all together, was going to Callings and talking to Aaron at Callings about this idea of an electric. And he said, he kind of encouraged the conversation to go towards, start with a pickup and then we'll build a guitar.
Hmm.
And I thought, well, yeah, of course. What pickups are underrepresented? Well, you know, there was a period where I thought, okay, it's got to be like a lipstick, you know, Dan Electro pickup, because those are also underutilized. You know, there's been a lot of excitement around rediscovering gold foils and super pickups and all of that. And that's been a really cool movement to kind of witness. But for me, I couldn't partake too much in it, even though I've bought guitars with those in recent years to try. Because the lack of fidelity at times for, I don't use effects. I play a deluxe set to two. Like, I'm quiet. There's nothing fun about my setup, you know? And so as a consequence, I just need the facts. I just need kind of clarity. And that, as we landed on the Dynasonic as an archetype, it was like, ooh, this is cool, because I know they sound good loud. I know they sound good quiet. And I think they respond well to semi-hollow instruments. That's why it just became like one of those ideas we couldn't drop once we were committed to it. It's too cool, you know.
I would argue against what you just said about nothing fun about your sound. You know, the live video of you playing, I think it's Tributary with your trio.
Okay, yeah.
That is, I think, some of the best pure electric guitar sound I've ever heard. Just the way that you played in that deluxe with those microphones in that room with that ensemble was incredible. And thanks, to me, that's fun. It's really fun.
I like it. But I zoom out sometimes and I see what other people, you know, get excited about with gear. And there's that setup and that tone is terrifying to play for me. You know what I mean? It's not so. I attribute it, the more the fun comment, to just the sensation from it, you know, like of playing it. It's not, it's kind of, again, no, who cares? It's just my own experience with it. But I spend a lot of time practicing DI into a computer and listening to it and just kind of marveling at all of the weird artifacts and things that, like, you know, the things that make you wince and you go, oh, that's awful. I need to click, 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 do all in it. And I stay there for a long period of time until I kind of go, well, what's the issue? You know? And it's not just for the sake of it. I really am curious what the emotional response is. Like, why am I feeling this way? Is, you know, you hear something, you go, oh, that's thin. Mm. And then I'll often listen to it and go, is it thin? Or am I playing certain things that produce overtones that are kind of collapsing on themselves? So I'm dealing with tone from a harmonic and melodic and phrasing point of view as much as I can. So I'm just looking for a tone that kind of just, you know, I've played a lot of guitars and amps and setups that are gorgeous, but it's not the point, because I don't I don't want the most interesting thing to be the tone from my perspective. I want from a listening perspective for it to be really, you know, inviting. But
is there a reason why you choose to practice that way, just so you just get the guitar and that sort of raw connection to the guitar itself?
Well, why do I do it? I don't know. there's a little bit of, you know, if you buy like really good paint, I'm thinking of interior paint, because we just painted a room in our house, or my wife Margaret did. I should take no responsibility. I didn't do anything. But I was there when we bought the paint, and we buy paint that, you know, is more than you need to spend on the paint maybe, but we're getting a small amount. So we say, okay, let's do it. And what I learned in that process with the pigment of this paint was far richer. So even as you do multiple coats, you still can tell the pigment has this other thing, and light kind of, it absorbs light a little differently and all that. So you have these layers when you're dealing with color. You're not just seeing a gray, you're seeing layers in the quality of the materials. I think of tone similarly, that even if I bury the most uncomfortable, unbearable, awkward, cringeworthy part of my sound, which you could say exists at the DI level, it's still the pigment of the tone when I plug into a two rock or, you know, or something. It's, or into a Neve console. That didn't disappear. It's just not on display. And in my experience, the more I cultivate a relationship with the pigment stage, then when I do plug into those amps, I can hear it in there and I actually like it. I go, oh, I hear this thing, and it's actually giving a certain amount of information that I can hear, and it just makes me feel more connected to the sound. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. It's almost like what I'm hearing you say is that you're listening for the things that might traditionally pull you away or take you out of what you're wanting to hear or your sound, and almost leaning into it. And when you're, I'm sorry, I'm not meaning to give it a thumbs up there, but so my follow-up question to that is, when you do hear something, when you're practicing DI that makes you wince,
yeah,
you're leaning into that, and are you trying to explore exactly what about that particular sound or voicing is making you wince, so that that's another color on your palette to use later?
Question. Sometimes, but not always. I would draw the attention more to the fact that for me, a lot of the winceable moments, let's say for the sake of argument, it's snappy, or it's like bright, you're playing and you're kind of like, ooh, that's not pleasurable. It's just kind of like, you're like being pelted by your sound. That for me is often a velocity thing in the right hand. So if I move quicker, it's more splatty. If I move a fraction of a second slower, I'm not saying slow down the line, I just mean the actual time it takes you to attack any given note. If I slow down the velocity, so I take a little longer to cut through the string, the high end gets curbed. If I slow down a little more, the high, it gets curbed even more. And then you can curb it so much that now you're just going too slow, or it's impractical, but you love the sound. So any sonic representation that I'm not keen with, it always comes down to speed. It's always velocity. It's always how quickly you went through the act. And sometimes it's the act of you play something and then I take my hand off too quickly. So there's this kind of like, it's like follow through stuff. You know, it's like, I'll check this. There's a phenomenon I experience all the time. Let's see if I can articulate it, where, let's say a 4-bar phrase with a DI guitar sounds like kind of bad tone. But then if I play a 12-bar phrase uninterrupted with the same tone, it's not as unpleasant. And that's the stuff I'm interested in, is because when you're, because it's about the music, right? It's all about the music. So if you're, what that tells me is this sensual realm is a little bit too abrupt to just visit briefly and get out and kind of play in a choppy way. But if I have a line that's actually really involved and complex and it keeps unfolding, that clarity and brittleness is actually helping the ear follow this, the voice leading and the overtones and all this stuff. And it becomes about the expression of the line, you know? So that it's interactive, less than, oh, I should make friends with the sound or I should get rid of it. There's no tone without lines. You know, there's you can't, you know, it's deeply interdependent. So that's the codependency and interdependency I'm fascinated with.
That's so cool, man.
That's great.
So you mentioned a moment ago, you were, did you say terrified of effects or you're
yeah, what, I'm like,
why, what about that? So explain that a little bit more. What about using effects, or is it specific types of effects? Is it time-based things, reverbs, delays, or is it modulation? Where does that come from?
Well, it's hardly rational, and I'm not blind to the fact that I am, for someone who is self-proclaimed not into effects, the equipment I use is fabulous, and it does these things that can totally be considered in the realm of great effects and great gear. So I'm not totally oblivious to my involvement with it. I just, reverbs, delays, I don't understand. It's kind of the only sensation I can say is equivalent is like if you see a dog near like a vacuum cleaner and they're, you know, they're freaked out by it, but you don't know if it's because it's high pitched or because it's loud or it's too close to them. That's how I feel. I don't like it. I'm sure on some deeper level, there's something to do with identity, you know, where I feel that this music, the blessing of this music is about expression. And if my attention is on something other than that, or has to go through kind of a series of decisions about more or less this or that, I feel like I've kind of left the domain of listening. That's really all it is. And countless people, all of you included, can do it all. You can pat your belly and do, you know, it's something you can work on. I just often haven't been in a situation where with the time I have that I can work on that aspect of it. So, I just haven't prioritized it, you know? And I think there's also, you know, there's a choreographical element to my fascination with playing guitar, which is to say that movement matters. And often what I don't understand with, well, just for the sake of argument, talk about more gratuitous effects, like something like a bunch of overdrive or a bunch of delay or a lot of anything. My movements don't coincide with the response of the pedal often. So I kind of feel like I'm in a split reality where I move quick and sharp, but the delay is set such a way that it's going on as if I could have played slow. I go, well, hey, this is a raw deal, man, because I'm doing this and getting that. I kind of feel cheated out of my own movements, you know, wildly irrational. But I also don't play music that really warrants much. So my setup is, you know, any pedal I use to date is just to, you know, it's a reverb or it's a clean boost or a tuner, you know, and that's works for me so far, you know.
Do you find that listening to music that is more reliant on effects is that something that you enjoy?
Sure. Oh, I love it. I think it's one of the coolest things about the guitar is the native space that guitars share with effects, you know, because all instruments try it and do it to varying degrees. But the guitar, it's, you know, no one bats an eye when you create a sonic atmospheric world on a guitar. It's just part of the thing. I remember I've talked to so many jazz musicians, non-guitar players who I've talked myself out of gigs several times where they go, man, I've been thinking of starting a band with guitar. And I was like, you should do it, you know? And they'll say, yeah, I just love how guitars can do all these effects and kind of do these things that keyboard players can do, but they can't. And I'm going, I know, it's amazing. It's so cool. And then they'll say, do you use effects? And I go, no. And they go, but you think it's cool? And I'll be like, yeah, you should hire someone who does it. It's like amazing. I'm not your guy. So I have a great affinity for it. And also, you know, I've been playing with Nels Klein for so many years and Frizzell for so many years. And they're what's so hip about them is I relate to them tremendously as improvisers, and they're able to look at their contributions as improvisers from a sonic point of view that I marvel at. They can use, you know, delay and loops and fuzz and all these things, like just huge, bold decisions that, but they're using them the way an improviser would in a jazz scenario or in a more avant-garde scenario. And I go, wow, that's cool. You know, or Fred Frith or somebody. And, but my, you know, my hero for so long has always been Derek Bailey, as far as, someone who uses an acoustic instrument without effects, but has the whimsy of someone who uses effects. And that, you know, so he's playing behind the bridge and string scrapes and different dyads and it's got all the, it's Technicolor, you know, it's like watching The Wizard of Oz, but you're watching someone do it with an acoustic instrument. So that world has always been more what I feel closer to. John Cage's world of prepared piano, or Terry Riley, is what I felt more akin to. So it doesn't mean you have, it's not like, it's not a life void of experimentation and noise and sound. It's just your means of it are just a little more localized.
There's such a commitment to learning a pedal as an instrument, the way that like Nels uses it.
Man, you nailed it. And that is precise. I should have said that, because, and I so appreciate you saying that, because it's not for me, it's not like I don't want to do it disservice. Nels knows these pedals. Frizzell knows it. They know them like the back of their hands. If I go turn it on, go, hey, I'm playing with effects, it's a little bit disrespectful to that thing, you know? And I'm not okay being in that realm of disrespect. You know, I know what it takes and I haven't got it, and I'm okay with that. So that's probably more accurate.
That's a really great perspective, though, that I have a lot of respect for, is understanding like, hey, you know what? That's beautiful. And I love that. And I respect it. That's just not my voice.
Absolutely. And
that's great. I think guitar players sometimes, or musicians in general, can sort of feel pressured, you know, especially when it comes to the gigging thing, you know, when a gig is offered to you, like, well, yeah, I can do that. So I love your perspective of like, yeah, just that's not my thing.
It's important to know what's not your thing. It's very liberating, you know. I mean, I find great comfort in the boundaries of kind of the toolkit, you know. Okay, you know, it's comforting. I go, okay, well, yeah, okay, given this and given the volume I like to play and given the music I like to play, I've got some paths that I have to dedicate myself to, and that's the full-time obsession. So, but said and asked and imposed. I appreciate you bringing that up.
So one other thing I've heard you talk about before is that you don't transcribe.
Yeah.
In your practice. Where does that come from? Because so many of us, myself included, were taught that transcription is a great way of practicing and learning. So why not? And where did that come from?
Well, gosh, I grew up similar to you, Red, and you know, I heard that it was good to transcribe, and I, you know, from teachers that I respect so dearly, and frankly, just on a objective level, hell yeah, transcribe, let's do it. Like, it's so, you know, it's not up to anybody but you to see if it has a home in your practice. And I understand the logic that states that you want to accumulate certain abilities, you should copy the people who do it, you know. It's not a hard concept to get on board with, but in my experience, there was something about transcribing when I would try it that I think it just drew my attention to parts of the music that weren't that important. So here I was spending hours trying to say, well, how do I write out this kind of triplet-esque thing that so-and-so did? And then, okay, now and how do I play and how do I match them? And I'd go through weeks of this kind of stuff. And then at the end go, I don't know if I'm any better, you know? And again, not from a false modesty point of view, not because I didn't want it to work. I'd love nothing more than for it to be a system where I go, here's something I like, I take it, I do it, I am it. Like, wouldn't that be great? I just, if I'm being honest, it wasn't my experience. You know, I often felt like it just kind of made me sick of the music I was transcribing rather than being lit up by it. And that bothered You know those things where you just cannot wait to hear that solo again, and just because it does something to you. But then when you kind of break it down to these elements, which I can't even say are the elements, they're just a way of objectifying and analyzing it. I didn't like them solo anymore. Mm. You know, it became about me and my acquisition of it. So there was something about it I was irked by. Now, just to be crystal clear though, instead of that, I just played with records. So if there's a solo I love, I accompanied it, or I comped for it, or I kind of did that Dixieland thing of soloing with it and being very clear which one of us was the better soloist, you know, is the one on the record, you know? And so it's a certain way of getting, kind of having, well, there's no way to say it, just getting my ass kicked, but in a friendly way. And I found more excitement and frankly, education from being the bad soloist next to a good soloist on a record than just trying to fill the shoes of the person I liked. You know, does that make any sense?
Yeah, 100%.
I think there's something that a lot of us, when we try to learn by, you know, transcribing something or looking up transcriptions,
yeah,
you want to convey the emotion of a player, but yes. So often, like if you listen to multiple recordings of the same song, they're never the same. So sometimes it's almost doing you a disservice to stay so regimented and having to learn things note for note.
Brother, absolutely. And keep in mind that the brain often is going to go along with whatever we ask of it. You know, so if you say, hey, brain, I'm coming to you today with this proposition, which says that Exhibit A is an awesome solo. And I need you to get it into you, brain. The brain's going to go, all right, you know, you're going to hate it by the end of this, and it's not going to make you a better player, but anything you want, Lush, like, I got you. You know, so you do have to be nurturing and kind of conscientious with what you take in and what you ask your body, because it will do it. You will learn it. You will be able to do it that way. You will come to a belief that the way to learn solos is to learn solos. And it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy where and so I think I was, for whatever reason, sensitive to the fact that I didn't want to get caught up in that cycle. Now, a couple important, really important caveats. There is music that I think natively lives, let's say, on a page, if we're talking about transcription in a traditional sense, and like, let's say, classical music. And I used to do that a lot, where I'd say, okay, Beethoven string quartet, I wouldn't make it far. It would take me a month to get like 8 measures. But I, you know, a score exists. I have enough understanding to know that that has a native logic on a page. And, you know, it's that classic thing that composition teachers will have you do, where you take the score and you write down on your paper the first, let's say, note, first chord. And then, so you know what your starting pitches are, then you put away the score and you just listen to the record and you try to fill it. You keep it going. That's fantastic. You know, that's a study of harmony, study of the grand staff, a study of how instruments work, orchestration, voice leading. That gets me really excited. But like knowing a certain improviser solo and being able to do it, I felt like maybe one piece of the puzzle, maybe an incomplete thing.
So advice would you give to someone who is maybe, you know, has taken that advice of learning solos note for note, playing by ear, which is what I have done off and on for years. Yeah. And my experience has been oftentimes it ends in mostly just frustration and anger. I'm a terrible chameleon. Like there's some players I've found that can just put on these masks and just play exactly like Stevie or you know, Robin Ford or whoever. And my experience was that when I'm trying to transcribe this Robin Ford solo, I sound nothing like Robin, and it's difficult to kind of get under my hands, and then it just gets frustrating. So, but there's a lot of the things about the vocabulary and the phrasing that I want to incorporate. So how were you able to take sort of the meat of what you were trying to learn without transcribing the stuff?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, I relate to you tremendously, because I'm a terrible mimic. I kind of can't help myself but sound like what I sound like, you know. It's and okay, you know, and I know players too who can, they can take it on and do it, and they seem really fulfilled. And so I appreciate you putting the question there, because yeah, that's puzzling, isn't it? Really, why does that work for them but not for me? Here's what drops in is that the most vital thing is how the music that we're hearing relates to itself within the ensemble. So it's not just a solo, it's a solo in relation to a rhythm section. And it's not just the beat that the drummer's playing, it's how that interfaces with the bass player and how that interfaces with the sound of the band, how that interfaces with the room and the audience and so on and so forth. So the trouble with transcription sometimes is you strip the vitality of what's being played of its context, you know? So if I were trying to figure out how to access, let's say, a Robin Ford solo, and I knew that just acquiring it and stripping of it of its context wasn't really doing it, it just made me feel bad that I wasn't Robin Ford, or fill in the blank. I have a million people I've had that feeling with too. The first thing I would do probably, again, just me, I'm not saying this like what you should do. I'm just saying, what if it was me sitting in this room thinking about it? I would probably play long tones on the guitar, almost like a bass line behind the solo. So like if it's over a 12 bar blues, I would just, you know, basically play the most rudimentary bass line without any embellishment behind the solo like 20 times so that I can understand what it feels like to be impacted by the phrases that Robin's playing. So, you know, you're the stud, you're the control. These are the chords. This is when the harmony shifts. That's all I'm doing. And I think if you do that enough, you go, oh my God, he's, that was really cool. I thought he was going to keep going and he stopped and it left this negative space. You know, something Robin's so masterful at is kind of getting forward momentum without just putting his foot on the gas. He's, and I hear that coming from Miles' tradition so much of like you kind of start on something and then you wait and you wait. And you wait, and you're able to get this impact over a longer period of time than if you just went for the more obvious conclusions. So that to me would be a wonderful outcome from studying a Robin Ford solo. It's just like, I want to feel what it's like to be next to it. And then if you hear something that you go, well, I think I've like deduced a lesson from this. Let's say you deduce from it that I noticed that I played with this 20 times and something Robin Ford does is he starts this way and in the middle he kind of does this and then at the end he does that. The next thing would be to turn off the record and play a solo that matches that architecture and then listen and go, is it, did I do it? Did I do it? And what you might find is, no, it wasn't it at all. You go, great, good. So it's not because he did this that it's good. Now I'm going to go back and play, you know. So you're trying to kind of derive lessons from it. But the key thing to me is, you're the teacher, you know, you get to, you're kind of trying to break it down enough that you could teach it to someone else. So I think it's a more empowering space rather than, oh, I suck and they're great. And if I just have a little bit of whatever they're drinking, I'm going to be awesome. I think that's a dead end.
Yeah.
I think it's a dead end. We all know it. And it's paved with the best intentions, but it's a drag, man. Quit. Yeah. Like, that's not it. Go start a garage band and play some awesome music. Don't feel bad about not being Robin Ford. So, but you be feel good about being kind of a teacher. I said there was a couple things though, and I have to be cognizant of you guys' time because I don't want to just talk your ear off. But my father was the greatest guitar teacher I've ever been around. And he had this ability to, and I talk about him, I know it as any chance I can, but it's really important to state that he possessed this ability I haven't ever seen anywhere else ever, which was that he could kind of objectify and deduce just about any medium. He was a visual artist and a guitar player. And we started around the same time. So he started in his 30s and I was 4 or 5. And we would play together and we'd go to lessons together. And he had the most elegant way of taking what you could be considered like adult concepts and explaining them to a 5-year-old, because that was kind of what our relationship was based on. A friend of mine reminded me the other day of something I guess I told him and I forgot, but earlier on I was practicing, you know, okay, I learned the apentatonic scale and my dad would play a 12 bar blues and I would solo and I just kind of go up and down the scale. And my dad said, oh, okay, I have an idea. Come with me to the kitchen. And I went with him to the kitchen and he filled up a glass of water. And he said, okay, when you were solo, and remember, this is, we're talking about a very nurturing, kind man. So the, none of this, this isn't heavy handed. It's just kind of beautiful. He filled up a glass of water and he said, okay, so we're playing the blues and you're soloing. What's happening, Julian, is when you solo, you're dumping out the glass of water. And he dumped it out. And he said, sometimes you'll do it like this. And he just did it a little slower, but it was still within a few seconds, the glass was empty. And he said, what I think the players we really like are doing, and we were talking at that time, we were listening to a lot to John Lee Hooker and T-Bone and just all the, you know, Muddy Waters and everybody. And he said, I think they're doing this. And he filled up the glass and he poured out a little bit, you know, and then he poured out a longer pour, but then he would stop it. And then he would just hold the glass. And then there's this much left. And he was able to pour it out in like three more pours. And he said, I think that's what we're doing, you know? And I thought, I love it. Cool. And then I'd go work on it. But apart from that, just being so meaningful and soulful to me as a child with my father, when I look at his ability to have, to analyze, but never slip into that kind of self-hating, worthless zone, I think it's profound, man, because I think he's right. I think it's just understanding how to pour the water out. And if you can find a healthy way to do that, that fits your brain and your heart and your abilities, you're going to do great. And that's why, that in answer to your question, the trouble I have with transcription, moreover than anything, is the fact that people don't question its validity. So my advice to anyone looking to transcribe is go transcribe your face off. And if you get symptoms that you hate it, listen to them. That's all. That's all, you know.
Wow. Man.
As a father, that's some awesome advice that I'm going to implement in my life.
I'm sure you're doing great.
Man, I think we'd be amazing. Remiss if we didn't speak to me.
Oh, yes.
Just came out.
The record out. That's right. Well,
so yeah. Can you talk about it? It seems like a pretty wide exploration of a lot of different ideas.
Yeah, I guess it is. You know, I there's a lot of acoustic guitar on the record, which I like, and that mixed with electric in a way that I've avoided for a while because I just kind of assumed you couldn't do. We've made all our records for so many years just in one room with no headphones, and so the thought of being with the rhythm section. Alone with acoustic guitar at the forefront just seemed kind of impractical, or it maybe put a better way. It would ask me to play harder to keep up with the drums. And then that's one color, you know? So I thought if I want to play nuanced, we need to change. So we made this record more traditionally, I guess, in the sense of, you know, headphones, people in booths. And yeah, it liberated me to kind of lead the charge with a more delicate sound. And I like the way it turned out. Joe Henry produced it and he's my hero, you know, and he knew exactly what I was going for with this record. A compilation of these almost spiritual melodies or hymns or gospel songs. That was always the intent, but framed in an unorthodox way, you know, where you would see glimmers of this working trio, that in the agency of a working trio that can kind of turn on a dime and do all this stuff, but with some of the more cinematic qualities of a larger ensemble. But the cats we got to be the larger ensemble are such improvisers in their own right. So it's Chris Davis on piano and Levon Henry on woodwinds and Patrick Warren on keyboard and sound. So everyone's improvising the whole record, you know, and one of the my favorite part of the record was that Patrick, who's such a beast, he was in the room with us, but had asked that we basically that we don't hear him in our cans because the intent was he was going to play along with the band and then go home and add to it. So for the whole record, I didn't know what Patrick was playing. So it was kind of like making a trio record until I go into the booth and then hear what Patrick was doing, go, oh my God, like, yeah, it sounds incredible and wildly different. It was such a sneaky and great way to experience it because I think had I heard him while it was going down, I would have changed my playing quite a bit. There's a healthy degree of ignorance and belligerence on my part on this record, or I'm kind of burr, 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 here's where I am, here's where I do the thing. And then you zoom out and you hear everyone's contribution and it's just fantastic.
So it's like you weren't reacting to each other. He was just reacting to you.
Yeah. And I've heard of sessions done like that. You hear people do that a lot, you know, where you, I shouldn't say a lot, but in a certain scene, you know, yeah, where you have like, maybe it's an improvised record and the rhythm section can hear each other, but the soloist thinks is can't hear the rhythm section. And then you put it all together. You know, I think sometimes reactivity is overrated, at least in the world that I'm in. It can become kind of a, I don't know. Like you play something that I know that too. And I play it and you go, okay, we both played it. You know, it's like that scene from Dr. Strangelove where the president is talking to the Russian cat. And they're both trying to say who's more sorry, you know, about the atom. No, I'm the most sorry about it. You know, it's kind of, it gets into one of those things with improvisers where like, no, I'm the most aware of how cool this is. No, it's like, just ignore. And if you listen to the masters, a lot of them, they're not reacting, you know, in that the way we're taught in school. Or you look at Ornette and Don Cherry or some of these, or even Miles and all these bands. It's like, everyone has their own mission that has integrity and you just trust they're going to blend. So that's kind of what happened on that record. But the most stunning thing to me really is Mark Goodell, our engineer. I mean, the record sounds really great. And that's
sounds incredible.
It sounds, and Mark's made all of our records for the last many records, and he's the front of house for all of our shows. I mean, he's as integral to the band as anybody. So, I just love how he captured it. And I just love the way, I mean, that's a magic trick, I think, you know.
It's a beautiful record, man. It's really, really beautiful.
I'm glad you like it. I'm really glad you like it.
Shall we dip a rig?
Okay. I have one. Now, this might, I don't think it's going to shock you, but it's it's a different sort of rig. We're just going to go real quick. Let me know when you can see it.
Ooh.
Bam.
Wow.
Whoa.
So I was going through our email. This is from our friend Devin. And we've done one of his rigs in the past, but he's kind of updated it. So what we've got here is a newer, 2005 Custom Shop 62 reissue SG. Wow. That he's done a lot of work on. And a 63 Les Paul Jr. SG. Les Paul Jr. Friedman Little Sister 20 watt head with a 2x12 cab, and then an assortment of other stuff. But on the pedal board, we've got a Peterson tuner, we've got the Mythos Argonaut Octave Up, a Phaser, a Minitone Red Snapper, a Lightspeed, a Boss CE2 Chorus, and some Strymon stuff. We got the L Cap, the Flint, and the Vertex Boost. So, what do you guys think of this?
It's great.
Yeah, this is beautiful. I mean, I love the 2SG setup. It's very similar to my 65 Junior over there. Mm-hmm. What does he say what all he's done to that custom shop? I mean, obviously there's some different pickups in there, but what, anything else changed?
Oh. Sorry, I have a U-line delivery. new pickups. He's had it refinished with vintage nitro. Talk amongst yourselves for 2 seconds.
Okay.
Wow.
Julian, are you much of an SG guy? I don't know that I've ever seen you play.
They're great. It's all neck. It's all neck. Yeah, I played one of Alan Holdsworth's recently, a friend had in his collection. It was, they're amazing. I kind of get why they're the, you could argue that they're a perfect guitar in a way. You know what I mean? If you're just looking at what they allow you to do, their capabilities, et cetera. And I never played one long enough to get used to the weight, you know.
It is a weird, they're not often balanced very well. And it is weird to get used to, you know,
right.
Especially if you're used to bigger body guitars, you know.
Oh, it's a trip. I would love, I think I would have a blast with one. I mean, both of those are so cool. And
I bought a Junior a couple years ago from Maple Street Music here in Atlanta, and it's amazing, but you have to find one that is balanced, because if it neck dives, there's just, you know, nothing you can really do about it, you know?
Yeah. I understand that.
So we'll move on to the pedal board. We're waiting on Zach to get back here. I mean, I think this is a pretty well balanced rig. I've not seen one of those Red Snapper, pedals in a long time. Those were huge. I think that's a drive. I'm not familiar with that particular one, but seemed like 10 years ago, those things were everywhere. Mm. I used to see them a lot here in Atlanta, but I don't know. They kind of, Zach,
sorry about that.
The red snapper. I feel like I used to see those all over the place, that Minitone, but I haven't seen one in a while.
So the red snapper is like a really low gain overdrive. It's kind of similar to the Gainster or R Olympus, the Mythos Olympus. So it's just kind of out of the way, just a nice low gain drive. But I mean, it seems like Devin here is going for a very specific classic rock sort of situation.
Is that right? Is that what that would sound like? I don't know what that sounds like, what anything is. So is it like loud and driven and...
I imagine most of the gains coming from the amp, or the amp is set to medium, you know, gain to edge of breakup territory. And so the pedals on the board are there to just kind of push it over the edge. Wow. You know, Light Speed is a nice light to medium gain pedal. It's one of my favorite pedals of all time. Mm-hmm. The Vertex Boost is, I think, the best boost for just clean, transparent, no color, just make your signal louder and not change it at all. That's kind of cool. the MO of that thing. CE2 classic, can't go wrong. And then arguably two of the best Strymon pedals, the L Cap and the Flint. I mean, what more can you ask for? Now I see the Klon up there too. That's just for display purposes only, I imagine, because it's not on the board, so we can't count that as part of this rig.
No, I guess not. He's just got it there. He says his normal gig is doing covers of like Zeppelin, Sabbath, Beatles, stuff like that. So
this rig is perfect for that.
Perfect for that. So
wow, that's amazing. What's that green one next to the Klon?
So that's a Rehouse Nobles ODR1, which. You might actually like is like a real low gain drive because it kind of has a real fat low end.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, that's nice.
So it a lot of people with like Telecasters into small Fender style amps, it kind of rounds out the bottom.
Yeah.
But you have to look that up. I like the sound of that.
Yeah. Well, man, what would you guys kind of rate this at?
You know, honestly, I'm happy with the guitar setup. Traditionally, I like a little variety. But you really have, I mean, you've got the single coil thing with the Junior, you've got the dual humbucker thing, and knowing what Devin is playing with the Sabbath and Zeppelin type stuff, you don't need a Strat, you don't really need anything, you know, like a Gretsch or whatever. So the guitars, I think, are solid. Pedal board laid out really well. I think you've got enough gain staging to where you can stack things and get a few different options, but you're not going... too heavy-handed. I always like two drives and a boost because you can do all kinds of stuff with that setup. And then the amp, I don't think I would change anything on this rig.
Yeah, this is really solid.
It's gorgeous.
All right. Okay, Julian, I'm 10 out of 10.
Yes.
What I would have built.
That is a Julian Lodge rig if I've ever seen one there, man. Let me tell you.
Next time at the station end, just bring something like this. Or I'll have it waiting there for you.
Zach. Oh, man, you're so sweet.
yeah, man. Okay, honestly, yeah, I'm going to give this a 10 as well. There's not anything I would change here. It's perfect. For knowing what the gig is, this is right on the money.
Same. This is great. Dude, I love it.
Good.
Is this the first... perfect 10 with guest and all three, like everyone?
30 points.
This might be an all-time high.
Well, look, guys, I'm glad I could contribute.
setting course records out here.
Sorry about my U-line call. I hit, you know, you got to schedule these truck deliveries and stuff.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, you got business to do. Julian, where can people catch you? You're going on tour coming up?
On tour, yeah. We start on the 15th, I think. 15th, is that right? 16th. We'll be on the East Coast working our way. We go to Knoxville, Tennessee. That's the closest we'll be to Nashville on this trip, I think.
Oh, okay. Where are you playing in Knoxville?
The Big Ears Festival at the Tennessee Theater. Okay.
Cool.
And
nice.
I'm excited because before our set, we'll also do my trio will be do a set with Joe Henry as his band. And
cool.
I'm very much looking forward to that. But yes, we'll be around playing the music. It's evolving, lovely. And anyway, yeah, we're just out there. I hope I see all of you guys.
Yeah,
don't shy ever. Always say hello and it'll be fun to hang out in person.
We'll have links to the new record and Julian's tour dates and everything in the description box down below. Man, this has been a privilege. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. We really appreciate it, man, and happy to have you back anytime.
Well, yeah, pleasure's thanks. All mine. I love you guys. Thank you. See you soon, okay?
All right. See you, man.
Bye.
Dude, that legitimately, I think, is my favorite interview I've ever done on any podcast ever.
He's just so damn insightful.
He really is, man. I feel like I could talk to him for all day about this stuff. Just like learning about his philosophy and his approach to guitar is so nuanced, and there's so many, like the whole thing about him practicing DI, that never occurred to me. I always thought about playing DI as sort of a party trick or something for like recording, you know, it's a specific, yeah, it's an effect, but hearing how he just sort of leans into it is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And the bit about like pouring out the water of the glass, like as a father of a 5-year-old, like there's always those little things. You're like, how do I break through to this kid about anything? Yeah. How do I explain it in a way that makes sense? And I think that is so applicable, not just for a kid, but literally everybody. What just monumental advice that is.
Yeah. So go support Julian. If you don't follow him already, go follow him. Go listen to his records. Even if you are not a jazz person, his music, I think, transcends that. His guitar playing transcends that. It is beautiful and dynamic, and just his sound. If you're not familiar with his playing, just put on one of his records and listen to the guitar sound. It is like whatever he does, whether it's an acoustic or an electric, it's like the most pure representation of a guitar sound that I've ever heard. I love it.
And it's so undeniably him. It doesn't matter what he's playing or what he's doing. You immediately know that it's his fingers on the fretboard.
Yes. Yes. Awesome. All right. Shills, what do you got?
Yeah. You go first.
Okay. This one was actually a Christmas gift. I don't think I've shilled this yet, but my wife, Tilly, got this for me for Christmas. It is the Teenage Engineering KO2 sampler. So this is a sampler. Use it to, you know, make beats and make tracks and all kinds of stuff. If you know anything about the Teenage Engineering brand, you know they're equal parts design house and musical instrument manufacturer. I mean, it's just a great thing to look at.
Yeah.
This is my first sampler. And a few weeks ago, I talked about, you know, I bought the Digitact, and I bought this because I started on this. And if you're interested in sampling and production and things like that, this is a really cool place to start. It's relatively affordable. I think like $300, something like that, $350.
Sure.
And they did have some quality control issues. Like mine has the weird fader that a lot of them have, but I think they got that fixed. Anyway, it's a ton of fun, man. You can just sit and, you know, it comes loaded with a bunch of really cool sounding samples, and you can just build a whole track in this thing, and there's cool effects in it. It's a great practice tool I've found for guitar, where you can kind of just plug in a beat super easy, you know, put a bass line down, put some chords down or whatever, and then just start playing over it. It's a ton of fun. So, yeah. And then just look at it. It's battery powered too. So you can use it anywhere. Like, look at that screen.
Man, it reminds me of old, like Texas Instruments calculators or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It does have, I think that's kind of what they were going for.
Was or like Radio Shack stuff, yeah. Or I don't know. It's cool. I like the orange and the grays, and it's neat.
Yeah.
That's neat. I like it.
It's great. I love it.
I have something that you probably would not expect me to have. I have a Telecaster.
Oh, good God.
So, we did our video on modding the Epiphone, special, and it did really well for me. And so the next logical step for me was a Tele. So I got this Ventura 2 from Franklin Guitar Works, MIRC down in Franklin, where they refurbish and restore stuff that would be otherwise considered, you know, like B stock or I don't know, might never get sold again. So they take that stuff and fix it up. This has like the tiniest scratch on it. This is an incredible guitar. I really like it, but I'm excited to start tweaking on it. But yeah. Telecaster.
The Ventura stuff, man. We're doing a video on the Jazz Masters. So like the 5 levels of Jazz Master. And I had Sweetwater send out 5 different levels. And one of them was the Ventura 2 series. Mm-hmm. And it's great, man. It really, really delivers.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's a well-made guitar, but there's my shill. Thanks again to everyone over on Patreon. We appreciate your continued support of the podcast. And if you want to learn more about it, go to the link in the description below and check it out on patreon.com.
And thanks again to Stu Mac for sponsoring today's episode. Don't forget StuMac.com/dippedintone. Get 10% off your order. Go get you some stuff to keep your guitars in shape and, and you know, good playing condition as we transition from winter to spring. So
it's gigging season.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Thanks, everyone, for watching. Thanks to Julian for joining us today. We will see y'all real soon on the next one.
Bye-bye.